we don't do it right, we'll see things get shut down. But I believe that we can do it right, and we've earned the right way to do it. That means that more Angelenos will be able to earn a paycheck, pay for their rent, put food on their table. It means that small and medium-sized businesses that are the bedrock of community wealth and our main streets will be able to have the same competitive advantage that we've given to others, that they can stop counting the days to bankruptcy and instead begin to restore their balance sheets and get back to providing the services that we all count on.
Mayor Eric Garcetti yesterday announcing that retail stores, churches, drive-in movie theaters, and apartment complex pools could all reopen. There are restrictions. Retail stores and houses of worship can only open if they strictly monitor how many people can enter. Social distancing and face covering still required. And businesses like nail salons and barbershops, they're not allowed to reopen yet. Garcetti's announcement came on the same day Governor Gavin Newsom relaxed restrictions statewide. The LA Times says there were 1,852 new COVID cases in LA County yesterday. 29 people died yesterday. But the county says over the past 7 days, the average death rate is down 3% and fewer patients are being hospitalized. Joining me now to talk about this is Dr. Timothy Brewer. He's a professor of epidemiology at UCLA. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, the mayor said we've earned it, and yet the number of deaths and the number of new infections is more now than when stay-at-home orders were first implemented back in March. So from your perspective, from a public health standpoint, is he doing the right thing?
So it's a balance between how do you protect the public health and how do you protect the economy. And what you have to remember is when the orders went in place, our case numbers were actually rising and our deaths were rising. If you look at the trends of case numbers and hospitalizations and deaths, while they aren't changing a lot, they've either plateaued or they've been coming down a little bit since about May 10th or so, around the first or second week of May. So I think we have, in fact, been able to change that trajectory from an outbreak that was increasing to an outbreak that is either stabilized or actually coming down a little bit.
So do you think that it was okay for him to make this announcement to reopen retail stores, houses of worship, some swimming pools,
well,
beaches,
etc.? So we have to do that at some point, right? So we can't keep the economy closed. So the question was when. It wasn't, is that ever going to happen? It was just when it was going to happen. And I think that this will be a learning process for all of us. The virus is clearly still spreading in our community. We have to be aware of that. And a key factor will be how does the public respond? So as we relax some of these stay-at-home orders, do we continue to do the physical distancing, wearing the facial covering, staying home when we're sick? All of these steps that were so critical in helping us to change the trajectory of the pandemic in our community.
Why has it been so stubborn in Los Angeles County in particular? We have had pretty early stay-in-place orders from a national perspective, and yet we are one of three cities that Dr. Deborah Birx mentioned as cities of concern. So why is it that LA has had so much trouble flattening the curve?
So actually, I don't understand why Dr. Birx chose to single out Los Angeles. So while our case numbers are high, that's because we have a very large population. We're one of the largest, if not the largest, county in the country. But if you look at case rates, so the Los Angeles case rate is running somewhere between 450 and 470 per 100,000. To put that in perspective, there are counties in New York and New Jersey that are eight times higher, over 3,000 per 100,000. There are counties in Georgia, Louisiana, multiple other states that are all over 1,000 per 100,000. So over two or three times what we're seeing in Los Angeles. So why she chose to single out Los Angeles does not make sense to me.
So, cautious reopening, what will you be looking for in terms of whether or not there are clusters or dangers in these new policies? Because we don't have the level of testing to ascertain precisely how widespread the outbreak is still, correct?
So the important part of that question is, you're exactly right that we need to continue to build out our public health response as we relax the stay-at-home orders. So what would I be looking for? I would be looking for the case numbers and rates. Are they changing? Are they going up again? What's happening with hospitalization? So if you look at hospitalizations, they've also been kind of flat or coming down a little bit. Do we see a surge in hospitalizations? All of these would be concerns that maybe the virus is getting ahead of us again, and we need to either ramp up our public health response, that's much preferable, or we need to ramp up the stay at home, which would be much less preferable.
The leader of Santa Clara's public health department, Dr. Sarah Cody, is really wary of these plans on the part of the governor to open up so much so fast. She's saying that why not open one sector up, wait 2 weeks, see what happens, and then cautiously reopen the other sectors, rather than saying, okay, retail stores, hair salons, houses of worship, you can all reopen. Does she have a point?
So it's a political decision, right? There's a balance. One of the things we've learned from the stay-at-home orders is the dramatic economic upheaval that occurs when you do this, right? So they're trying to balance both sides of the public health and the economy. And a poor economy actually has health consequences. So poverty increases your risk of heart disease, depression. It increases your risk of all-cause mortality. So there are health trade-offs to shutting down the economy in addition to economic and social trade-offs. So it's trying to find that balance. And I don't think anybody can claim for sure that we know exactly what the right balance is.
Do you expect that there will be another wave in the fall?
I do. Unfortunately, I think that part of what we will see over the summer is the natural physical distancing that occurs in the summer. So in the summer months, we spend less time indoors and we spend more time outside and farther away from people. So COVID-19 probably will drop during the summer, but it will not go away. And so as we return to schools, as we return to congregate settings, as we spend more time indoors, closer together in the fall and winter, I am very concerned that we will again see a resurgence of cases.
Dr. Timothy Brewer is a UCLA epidemiologist. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, as LA County takes another step toward reopening, it's also looking ahead to the start of the next school year. The county's Office of Education released guidelines for how to bring its 2 million students back to campuses this fall, suggesting things like students should have their own face masks, their own ball at recess so they can safely play all by themselves. Sounds a little dispiriting. With me now to talk about these guidelines is Howard Bloom, education reporter with the LA Times. Hi.
Hello.
Well, Howard, this does sound a little dystopian. A bunch of small children playing alone during recess wearing masks. Is that really what they're recommending?
Well, of course, you know, these healthcare guidelines could change, and maybe by the time the fall opens, we'll be in a better place and in a different stage. Maybe we'll be in stage 5 rather than stage 3, which is when schools can open in this modified way. So we're in a shifting environment, but that's one of the problems that school districts have is that they have to come up with multiple scenarios, and they may have to shift from one scenario to another on the fly. But yes, it is a little dystopian and dispiriting when we think of schools as a place that is, it's a place of learning, but it's also a place of socialization and fun for children. And this idea that you would be given a ball, but you have to play with it by yourself and no one else can touch your ball but you. Yeah, that's a little sad. That's a metaphor for kind of the experience that children might be going through.
And what about inside the classroom? What are the guidelines for that?
It's going to be really tricky. So if you take the size of a traditional California classroom, which is a little under 1,000 square feet, I mean, they have rules for these things, what counts as a traditional size. It looks like you could fit 16 desks in there with proper social distancing, and that's the number I used in the story. But as your KCRW exclusive, I will note that most classrooms have other pieces of furniture, and they have file cabinets, and they have a teacher desk, and they have a learning station. And they said with a typical classroom furniture, you'd be lucky if you get 12 seats in there. So one of the challenges of the pandemic is, where do you put all this extra furniture to clear out the class? Because if you have extra furniture in there, and then you also have extra cleaning and sanitation responsibilities. Now, if you also think about what a classroom looks like when you come in, there's a lot of shared supplies. For the young children, there's a carpet where they huddle together and listen to the teacher read books. Well, you can forget that huddle time on the carpet, and maybe you can forget the books as well, because that classroom library, that great classroom library that kids pull the book off the shelf and read, well, that's not a very sanitized environment if you think about it. So they may have to get their individual laptop and look at books on that, perhaps, if the district can afford to provide each student with a computer, which is something they're also looking at. And that whole thing of grouping desks together so that students face each other and work together on projects, well, that's not going to work either. You're going to have to put the desks 6 feet apart and all facing in the same direction. So this is going to be very different. And, you know, and we're also looking at staggered schedules. Maybe students come on Monday and Wednesday and Tuesday or Thursday, and then Friday is some sort of a planning or Zoom class session. Now, there are a lot of things to figure out.
Yes, this just sounds enormous, an enormous task ahead, and not that much time to work all of that out, not to mention the money involved with only 16 or 12 seats, 12 kids in a classroom, staggered schedules. How that's all going to cost more money. So
right.
Where is the district going to get that in a time of huge budget cuts?
Well, that's an interesting question, too. Apparently, the answer for the moment is nowhere, because the state budget calls for a 10% cut to education. And the education establishment, of course, is screaming about that. They're saying we need more money. Now, it could have been worse. Based on the budget, education could have looked at a cut of 20% or more. So it could be argued that Governor Gavin Newsom went to great lengths to spare education a greater cut than it might have had otherwise. But 10% is bad enough. Now, he's hoping, and lots of people are hoping, that the federal government will offer a bailout of some sort to spare these cuts. But, yeah, if you think about the additional cost, you know, the school district is going to have to offer three kinds of education programs at once, because there'll be some families that don't want their kids in school at all. There's some who need them in school most of the time. And then there are others who may prefer a hybrid program. And if you have split time, do you pay teachers for longer hours or hire more teachers? How do you pay for a glass? How do you pay for plexiglass shields in the office or places where you may need them, where you can't do social distancing the same way? You have gloves, you have signs, you have thermometers. It's a pretty exhaustive list. But the Glendale superintendent, Vivian Etchian, who I was talking with yesterday, she was talking that they may need to hire bathroom attendants just to sanitize and make sure things are going the way they should be in the bathrooms. I mean, just a few short months ago, we were just talking about keeping students from vaping in the bathrooms. Now things have gotten even more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how do you ensure that all these little kids adhere to social distancing? It's hard enough to wrangle them to just sit down and sit still and pay attention in the first place. But to comply with all of these extra rules, keeping their mask on all day long, it sounds impossible.
Well, it is. And for some students, actually, it is literally impossible. Some students have health conditions that preclude them from wearing a mask. And other students have disabilities that make wearing a mask either unsafe or just impossible to manage. And the students with disabilities, some of them have one-on-one aides who are unable to practice social distancing and still do their job. It gets very complicated. And how do you eat lunch with a mask on? So lunch involves a procedure. Maybe there won't be lunch. Maybe they'll have half days and they'll just send students home with a meal. I guess what people really want is for all of this to go away, mm-hmm. but it doesn't look like it is going to go away anytime soon. So you have to plan.
So these are guidelines, right? The districts don't have to adopt them?
Well, yes. That's a very good question. They're guidelines, and they really did try to think of everything they could think of and list links and resources that people could look at. And the way government works in California, school districts have a lot of independence, and the county education office is not in charge of the local school districts. They do have some financial oversight, and if a school district is about to go bankrupt, then they can send an advisor to take fiscal control. But pretty much school districts run their own show. But the one exception to that is county public health rules. So if there's anything coming out of the county public health department, school districts do have to adhere to that. And that's why they're planning for all-day masks, because at the moment, the county health rule is that if you go into a public space or if you go to a public space inside a building especially, you are supposed to wear a mask. So at the moment, they are assuming that masks are mandatory and that if a student comes to school without a mask or a face covering of some type, then the school has to provide that.
Howard Bloom, education reporter for the LA Times. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Coming up, does President Trump have a First Amendment right to say whatever he wants on Twitter? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. President Trump and Twitter are in a war over Twitter. The social media platform has labeled two of his tweets that disparaged vote by mail with fact checks. And Trump initially responded by complaining those fact checks violate his First Amendment rights, even though Twitter didn't flag his other tweets promoting a debunked conspiracy theory involving MSNBC host Joe Scarborough. Today, Trump took things a step further. He threatened to regulate Twitter and other social media platforms. That's something many of the big tech firms have been trying to avoid, obviously. And joining us to talk about what that means is Kevin Roos, tech columnist for The New York Times. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So those tweets involve California and Governor Gavin Newsom's decision to send mail-in ballots to every eligible voter. So why all of a sudden has Twitter decided to correct this misinformation? What's the official position now?
Well, Twitter, like Facebook and some other platforms, has really held a firm line on just a few specific types of misinformation, which involve things like voting and the census. And this one ran afoul of those rules. It is the exception rather than the rule. I mean, these platforms have said that most of the time they are in favor of, you know, leaving speech undisturbed in case, you know, there's political debate to be had.
And so the reaction, they must have anticipated the reaction that they would receive from the president. So they decided that that was worth it?
For sure. I mean, they've known that they've seen this happen to Facebook. They've seen it happen to other platforms. It's happened to Twitter before. The president and his allies really want these platforms to remain open to anything that they want to do there, to really just give them carte blanche to spread baseless information, conspiracy theories. I think the interesting question now is whether Twitter will kind of buckle and reverse stance, or whether this is going to be the start of sort of a more aggressive stance toward the Trump administration and other people who may be spreading voting-based misinformation.
Well, what conceivably could the Trump administration do to strike back legislatively?
It's not entirely clear. I mean, there could be, antitrust investigations. The president has a lot of sort of power in the executive branch to make life more difficult for these platforms. Ultimately, though, this is a freedom of speech issue. This is not not the way that I think people typically interpret it, as Twitter sort of stepping on the First Amendment rights of President Trump and his allies, but of the government actually stepping in to regulate and preclude private companies from taking certain actions. That actually is a constitutional issue. And so I think there's a limit to how far the Trump administration can push it without really running into that.
Right. So that's really interesting, the freedom of speech issue, because he's, of course, saying that his freedom of speech was violated. But this is a private company. They can do whatever they want, right, when it comes to this?
Exactly. And I mean, it's sort of wild to hear claims of censorship coming from someone who has tens of millions of followers on a platform. I think clearly if Twitter wanted to prevent him from getting his message out, it could have done a lot more to do that than what it's doing now.
So why aren't they doing the same with these Joe Scarborough tweets, where he's basically, the president is basically accusing him or raising the specter that he may have murdered someone in his office, which is completely false? Why isn't Twitter taking a stand on that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's a case to be made that if that were coming from some normal citizen, that it would be taken down. But Twitter has been very clear that it considers tweets from heads of state, from politicians, to be part of public discourse, to not have to follow the same rules as other users.
Meanwhile, Facebook has decided it wants no part in fact-checking. So why are they taking a different path here?
Well, Facebook does do fact-checking. They outsource it to a network of third-party fact-checkers, and they've done fact-checking on certain things that politicians have tweeted. But they are also saying that politicians are exempt from most of their rules. None of these platforms wants to be in the business of fact-checking every political tweet, of being the kind of arbiters of political discourse. So they're doing as little as they can get away with. And I think voting and the sort of process around voting is an area where they feel like they do have a duty. They can apply this principle in a neutral, nonpartisan way. They have some sort of justification for doing that.
So what does this look like playing out against, well, as we're in a pandemic, but also in an election year? What does this mean for these social media giants and how they're positioned to give people accurate information when they need it the most?
Well, this is going to be a constant battle for them. I mean, they are going to be they are the referees, right? And players on both teams are working the referees and trying to get their desired outcomes. In the case of Trump and conservatives, they generally want these platforms to take a hands-off approach. The left, I think, would like these platforms to take a harder line, but also, you know, there are some concerns about censorship on the left as well. So I think these platforms, you know, because they now control a ton of our political discourse, they're referees whether they want to be or not.
Hmm. Well, but do you think that the president will do what he has done to other news organizations that he doesn't like, just basically call them out as being biased and part of the lamestream media or what have you, that Twitter will now be tainted with that brush that he uses against, for example, your newspaper?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's already happening this morning. You know, the president and his allies are calling Twitter, you know, part of the biased liberal Silicon Valley machine, going after certain employees that they think are responsible for these fact checks. And Twitter will have to decide whether it cares more about keeping the president and his allies happy or about users receiving accurate and useful information.
And then both sides of the aisle, as you've said, are interested in reining in these social media giants, especially when it comes to election information and what's happening with, possible Russian interference all over again, that kind of thing. Do you think that in a strange way that this will unite both sides in a sense to do something to regulate sooner rather than later?
I don't think it will unite both sides because I think that each side wants something slightly different from the tech platforms. I think, you know, generally Republicans are concerned about freedom of speech and being able to say whatever they want to say and get amplified in the ways that they're used to. I think a lot of liberals and progressives are concerned with the power that these companies have in the market. Should these companies be referees? Should these unaccountable private corporations have control of global discourse and speech the way that they do? And if not, how do you shrink that influence or break them up? They will be united in anger toward the big tech platforms, although I think their goals are slightly different.
Is there any legislation actively being considered right now?
I don't know that there's any realistic legislation, and I think the White House has announced that it's going to be taking a hard look at anti-conservative bias by the big tech platforms. But ultimately, I mean, these are private companies, and they're allowed by law and under the Constitution to make the choices that they are, that they are making. And it's really hard to imagine a scenario in which the courts would uphold an attempt to kind of squash their freedom of expression, their freedom to run their services as they see fit. So I think the problem is less legal and more political.
Kevin Roos is New York Times tech columnist. His column, The Shift, examines the intersection of technology, business, and culture. Kevin, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a new documentary, The Painter and the Thief, explores what happens after the painter confronts the man who stole her painting.
I know that this is the emotion that I should naturally have. I tried my best to be angry, but I really could not get properly there.
A conversation with the painter and the filmmaker, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. 5 years ago, a down-on-his-luck drug addict and his accomplice, in full view of surveillance cameras, stole a pair of paintings from an art gallery in Norway. Not exactly the Thomas Crown affair. They were quickly caught, they went to trial, and in an Oslo courtroom, the artist decided to confront one of the thieves. But she saw something in that man that moved her, and an unlikely friendship followed. Benjamin Reed tells their story in a new documentary. It's called The Painter and the Thief, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great to have you. The painter herself is with us as well. Barbara Kasilkova is the artist and one of the subjects of the film. Welcome to you.
Hello, and thank you for having us.
Well, it's great to have you. Barbara, tell me about the theft of those paintings back in, that was like 5 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you had this art opening, and then some thieves went back to the gallery and cut the paintings out of their frames and just brazenly walked off with them?
Almost precise as you say, except of they did not cut the canvases out of the blind frames. And that was for me actually very striking moment when I saw how carefully the guys removed the canvases. You know, because I always prepare my own canvases, so I stretch it myself and I use nails. And these were really large scale paintings. So I would need half a day to remove the canvases from the blind frames. But these guys did really excellent, precise job in quite short amount of time, I would assume.
What did that tell you? Why was that intriguing for you?
Since they haven't left one single thread of the canvas around, I was really almost kind of flattered by their carefulness with which they did it, the thievery. You know, that it was not something, like they did not violate the canvas in any other way than just that they stole them.
Were you angry, though, when you found out that your paintings were stolen?
You know what? I know that this is the emotion that I should naturally have, but I tried my best to be angry, but I really could not get properly there. I was more going through a feeling of confusement because none of that really made sense to me of why anyone should break a law in order to get my paintings. You know, I'm not a famous artist. I'm not like Lucian Freud or Picasso. So why would someone break a law in order to get my art?
So you go to the courtroom where one of the thieves is on trial to find out. And when you see him, what do you see?
You know, I entered the courtroom with the already idea in my head that I wanted to approach the thieves and ask them whether they would pose for me while I would recreate the crime scene. You know, I wanted to make a big painting of how these two men steal my paintings. But then when I entered the courtroom and I saw this man sitting there with his head in his hands, feeling so small, trying to or wishing to be elsewhere, and the true sorry from him, I just couldn't help it. But I saw the pure human there that I really couldn't feel any anger towards.
Benjamin, what did you see in this story and how did you learn about it?
I found this story just in the front newspapers in Norway. And right after the trial, I contacted Barbara and asked if I could begin filming. Already then, there were a lot of archival footage. A friend of Barbara had filmed her for a long time. So I already got a lot of coverage before I came along. And in the beginning, I just wanted to explore and find out more about these two fascinating people. And I wanted to make a short documentary. That was my initial idea. So when I began filming, I did not know anything about where the story might end up. And there were so many surprising twists that happened. And I've kept on filming for 3 years.
What was one of the most surprising twists in the story as you began filming?
That's a spoiler alert, but it's many. One thing I can tell you that's not a spoiler alert is when Carl Bertil, the thief, sees himself painted for the first time in the film, he begins crying. And he cries for 10 minutes. And that was just unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it before. It was like this guy had been seen and appreciated for the first time in his life.
We actually have that clip of him, and let's play it. Let's hear him. And when he first sees the portrait that you, Barbara, made of him.
It's just started. Of course, a lot of work still.
Whoa.
But, just started.
Over. What the f***? You didn't have a... You did this from... No. Whoa.
So he, as you say, sobs for a long time. Barbara, tell us about that moment. Was that the reaction that you had expected when you unveiled the portrait?
How can one expect such reaction? That's, of course, you know, it's like for me as a painter that has been facing so many refusals with my work in many levels. And then such thing happens. To say it simply, then I understood that it does make sense what I'm doing. I also knew that Bertil at that time was in his quite weak moment in his life, struggling with addiction. And I hoped that when he sees that I started to paint him, it might maybe cheer him up a bit or give some more of a positive emotion. But what came out was beyond my expectation.
And the movie then after that shifts to his perspective, Bertil's perspective. Benjamin, why did you decide to do that? You were following Barbara's story for a while and then it shifts to his and he tells the story of what he sees in Barbara, which I found really interesting. It's not just a one-way street where Barbara is painting this vulnerable person. Bertil sees her as also someone who has had a tough life. Can you talk about that?
So the most classical way to tell this story with an artist and a muse would be to only focus on the artist's point of view. So we wanted to break free from that and do something differently. And that was exactly what you say. We changed perspectives. We see the world from Carl Bartel's point of view. And the main reason for it, it was basically because I wanted to get across what an intelligent, charming, charismatic guy Carl Bartel is, the thief. I really wanted the audience to get to know him. And I thought that the only way to do that was to see the world from his perspective.
Mm-hmm. And Barbara, you describe yourself as a painting junkie, which is an interesting turn of phrase because, of course, the thief is a junkie. So do you see yourself having a lot of parallels, a lot of similarities with Bartel?
Well, addiction can have many forms, you know. I kind of then dare to say that my addiction is probably less harmful than Bertil's used to be, though one should not underestimate the impact of turpentine. But yes, I am quite addicted to the painting. It's basically what I start to do when I wake up. I come to the studio, I start to paint, and then I just pass out, sleep. And the next day the same happens and nothing makes me happier than that. But I'm still staying with the painting. It starts to pay off a bit.
Well, let's play another clip from the movie. And this is where you are in a couples therapy session with your partner, Oystein, and he has some problems with your addiction.
One thing is a passion about painting and like I want to create this. But when it turns unhealthy in the way that you can stand there and paint and the whole world fall apart around you, this is insane for me. It's like, how can you put yourself in that situation? It's like letting your kid play in traffic. You don't do that.
Why was he so upset with you there?
I assume it's not probably the easiest partner. I'm not the easiest partner to have when I live the life as I do. But as well, I think Oystein does understand it more than anyone else could, because he himself is a writer. He's an exquisite writer who understands the moment when you're totally absorbed in your work. And I understand this is not the easiest bite to take as a partner for him.
But was he also upset with your relationship with Bertil, because you do end up spending a lot of time with him, you help him after he gets in a really bad car accident? Did he see that relationship as destructive?
Why should my partner or my boyfriend be angry that I have a friend? But I do understand your question. Of course, there was a lot of heavy moments with Bertil, and at the time there weren't so many people that would be there for Bertil when he needed to lift himself up a bit. But I don't want to speak on behalf of my boyfriend, but I know he is very intelligent man who does trust me, and I do trust him. So there is no other worry than just maybe if the destructiveness wouldn't take me a little bit too much. But I dare to say it has not and will not.
Take you where, though? Take you away from him? Take you away from healthy living?
Not away from him, but maybe to take me maybe even a little bit deeper to my own bubble. Mm-hmm. I assume, but as I say, I don't want to speak for him.
Benjamin, this is a portrait of two obsessive people. And I guess you're obsessive too, because you spent a lot of time on this movie, years on this movie. What did you learn about the creative process, about connection, about people?
I learned a lot during the filming here. And I think that what I'm thinking a lot about these days, that's the journey that Carl Bartel has. And like, he's at his lowest point in the film. He's having a lot of problems, both physically and mentally. And he's a drug abuser. And from there on, little by little, building himself up again. I think that's the most impressive thing I've ever experienced in my life. So I think that Bertil has given me a lot of hope. And I hope that he will inspire people that will watch the film as well.
And Barbara, did you ever get an answer to your original question, why Bertil and his accomplice stole your paintings?
The first one I got was the best one. And that's when I asked Bertil at the courtroom why he stole these paintings. And he just so purely answers, because they were beautiful. I did not get or haven't gotten any better answer than that yet. It was a very special appreciation, I think. That doesn't happen every day.
Well, thank you both so much for coming on today. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Barbara Kisilkova and Benjamin Rhee, they are the director and the subject of the new documentary, The Painter and the Thief, available now on Hulu. Coming up, sex in the pandemic, research on what's happening behind closed doors. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We are more than 2 months into quarantine, and we all have new routines these days. They don't involve going out much. So what has that done to our sex lives, whether partnered up or not? We're going to talk about that now with Brittany Blair, a clinical psychologist who specializes in sexual medicine. She's conducted some research into sex in COVID times. And here is the usual disclaimer when we talk about such matters. Make sure the people listening to this are the people you want listening to this. So we're going to have some frank discussions right now. And welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, let's start with the partnered up. You're sheltering in place with your significant other and you have lots of time on your hands. Is that time being used for sex, or some of that time at least, or is too much togetherness really a turnoff?
It's such a good question, and I would say yes and. So one of the things that we saw at the beginning of our shelter in place is we saw a decrease in reported sexual frequency. And this is consistent with what we know just in the general data in terms of the science of sex, is that when people are stressed, which I think we all could agree that it was a very stressful time, 85% of people experience a reduction in libido when they're stressed out. And for the vast majority of us, stress reduces the quality of our sex. So what we saw in the beginning of shelter in place was a significant decrease in sexual activity. And then as our stress kind of stabilized, or maybe we became even anesthetized somewhat to this collective trauma that we all are experiencing or have experienced, sexual frequency, both solo and partnered sex, actually increased. But one of the things that we saw, which is quite interesting, is for women in our data sets, we have over 13,000 women and 10,000 men that we're looking at this data from. With men, they were reporting a decrease in desire for their partner, not necessarily a decrease in sexual desire generally, but for their partner. And one of the reasons we think this is because for everybody, there's kind of a balance between the intimate and the erotic, right? So too much closeness or too much kind of intimacy, whether that be emotional, just kind of physical closeness, decreases the erotic. So every relationship needs some amount of distance in order to kind of fuel the erotic engine. And so that's one of our hypotheses as to why we see in men this lack of sexual desire for their partner. And then for women, what we saw is low sex drive across the board. So not just for their partner, but just kind of reporting low sex drive, and then difficulty climaxing consistently. So what we're seeing is men kind of want more novelty with their partner, then want to also be better in bed, and women want to experience more sexual pleasure.
But isn't that kind of par for the course when it comes to long-term relationships? No matter what, I mean, COVID or not.
Yeah, for sure. Yes. We're not hardwired to be monogamous. And what I always like to tell people is that 6 months into a relationship, and more for women than for men, which is surprising to many people, that spontaneous lusty desire that we have for our partner starts to dissipate. But it's actually not the end of the world. What then starts to happen is we have what we call responsive desire, which means once you'd agree to engage in sexual activity or erotic thinking and become aroused, then the sexual desire follows the arousal. So it's a little counterintuitive, but a lot of people think, oh my gosh, something's wrong with my relationship because I don't have that spontaneous, lusty desire for my partner anymore. And when in fact, that is completely healthy and normal. It's just that the desire may follow the arousal post 6 months in a relationship. For men, that spontaneous desire lasts usually up to 2 years and is just more stable than for women.
So how has sheltering in place changed that or accelerated that in any way? What have you learned or what's different now about sex now that we are spending so much time with our significant other, if we do indeed have a significant other? And I'll get to the singletons in a moment.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, kind of like we were just talking about, I think that we're finding this kind of impact on sexual desire from spending so much time together. So that's one piece on the negative side. On the flip side of that, what we're finding with our Lover, which is this app that we're using to kind of collect data on this, is we're finding that couples are prioritizing exploration and novelty with each other, which is quite interesting. So maybe my hope would be that this means that couples are spending more time together and thinking, huh, maybe some of this time we can actually enhance our sex life or increase the novelty in our sex life. We're seeing, couples reaching out for resources on how do we spice things up at this time. So that's kind of exciting to me that couples may be reducing our busyness outside of shelter in place. And, all of us kind of hustle and bustle before this happened is actually giving us more time to prioritize an erotic connection with our partner.
Well, how are they spicing things up? Not to get too graphic about it, but are you noticing different practices, behaviors?
Yeah, so it's super fascinating. We have there's a profiler similar to a Myers-Briggs in this product that actually asks the user to answer 32 questions. And then those 32 questions hang on 8 different dimensions about what we know about sexuality. And what we find is that with this, again, 13,000 women and 10,000 men, is that women match this profile that we've labeled the sovereign, which basically means that they kind of want to take charge in bed, teaching their partner. And again, we're being quite heterosexist about this, right, as we're talking about this data set, but the vast majority of this data is from heterosexual couples. But women want to take charge in bed in terms of teaching their partner how to pleasure them, whereas the men who are completing this profile are reporting that they want to be a bit more adventurous in bed, but only with a trusted partner.
And then I noticed in your research that people are buying more accessories, shall we say, than they have in the past?
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is for both partnered and non-partnered people, right? People think about sex toys as being for folks that are single. And I think sex toys can be quite a fun way or accessories, shall we say, it can be quite a fun way to spice up sex with a partner as well. So we're seeing an increase 175% by week.
But could that increase also be because a lot of people aren't with a partner and they're home alone?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. They're not with a partner. They're home alone and they want something new to experiment and play with.
So how is that working? We can segue into the singleton sex life. What's happening there?
Well, with non-partnered people, if you think about folks that are single and even trying to date during shelter in place, is that people are actually going deeper. We're all going through this kind of collective trauma, which kind of introduces a level of vulnerability. And that vulnerability is a unique birthplace for intimacy. And so we're finding this as people are dating, that they're really kind of having a deeper, more authentic connection than previous to shelter in place. And also people are now doing much more, both non-partnered people and couples that are a long distance are doing much more kind of online sex or phone sex or video sex. And I think this is also kind of an explanation for this skyrocketing sales of sex toys or accessories.
Mm. Oh, interesting. So what are healthcare officials recommending when it comes to sexual activity? Do you envision a future where you're dating and each person has to produce a negative COVID test before they have sex?
Oh, I don't even want to think about that. I will say that that is a common comment both among my patients and just looking at the data right now is that people are joking about that, right? The concern is much more about COVID than any other STI. So I think there is concern. And I also think that people are just a little more skittish now about having close physical contact with an unknown other. So this is not based on any data, but my prediction would be that coming out of this thing, we see in terms of sexual activity, we see a lot more friends with benefits kind of sexual activity than casual hookups.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that people will be more skittish in terms of getting into a relationship at all?
My guess is, and again, this is not based on any data. This is just a semi-educated prediction. But my guess is that we're going to see a couple of things. I think we're going to see, one, a lot of couples that were kind of staying together out of convenience are going to split up. Because I think for all of us, we're having this sense of, oh my gosh, we've got one life to live. I want to actually maximize it, right? And then I think we're actually going to see a lot of couples who have forged a bond and actually move forward more seriously. I heard someone talk about within 5 minutes of COVID, everybody is experimenting with monogamy, right? Like that no one's really interested in kind of going to parties or being non-monogamous at this point. So I actually think we'll see a deepening of some bonds. And then I think we'll see a lot of long-term couples actually split up as a result of this as well.
Well, Ona, thank you so much. That was fascinating.
Yeah. You're more than welcome. Hopefully it's helpful.
Brittany Blair, she's a clinical psychologist who specializes in sexual medicine. And that's it for our relationship for today. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.